Hi, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Robin, and you're listening to Bowel Moments,
the podcast sharing real talk about the realities of IBD.
Served on the rocks.
This week we talked to Abigail von Hoos. Abigail was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, and we go on her wild ride of living with ulcerative colitis without really knowing what she was suffering with and trying to find a treatment option while cycling through many, many doctors and not getting great care. This eventually led her to start this specific carbohydrate diet. And since Abigail is a chef, this was a great challenge for her to take on, and she started creating recipes and decided to share it on a blog called Abigail Marie, Chef with IBD. So we talked to her about her blog, we talked to her about creating recipes, we talked to her about her work with nutrition therapy for inflammatory bowel disease, and so much more. And we even share some of her favorite recipes in our show notes. Enjoy! Cheers!
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bowel Moments. This is Robin.
Hey, guys. This is Alicia, and we are so excited to be joined by Abigail von Hoos. Abigail, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
We are so excited to hear your story in just a second, but very first unprofessional question for you is, what are you drinking?
I am drinking some hot peppermint tea right now with some honey. Yeah, it's a little chilly here in North Carolina.
Well, I happen to love peppermint tea with honey, so I approve. Robin, what are you drinking?
I am also drinking tea. I am drinking a lovely ginger and lemon tea.
Oh, another good choice.
Yes.
I'm also drinking ginger. However,
yours has alcohol in it.
Oh no, that's the one I just drank. I just drank an orange ginger sparkling water. But I said on another recording that we're not sponsored by Topo Chico. We just happen to be big, giant fans. And yes, they came out with a whole line of like flavored sparkling waters that are like kind of fancier than their typical ones. So the orange ginger one is one. And then they have another one that's lime and mint. And so I made myself a drink with it. I'm drinking a ranch water with lime and mint sparkling water. So I don't know if it's still a ranch water. But anyway, so yes, that's my drink tonight.
Oh, appropriate with the American flag representing Texas and your ranch water.
I was like, isn't Topo Chico from Mexico?
Is it?
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure
it is Mexican. Topo Chico is Mexican sparkling water.
I need a drink, Mexico ranch one.
Water, I believe, was invented in Texas.
It's good. I'm a fan.
Abigail, we're so happy you're on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Next question for you is, what is your IBD story? What brings you into our community?
Yeah. So when I was 21 in 2014, I was actually in a really bad car accident and got hit head on by a tow truck that came over into my lane. And when the paramedics pulled me out of the car, I was like holding my side and was like, my left side, and was like, it really hurts here. And they were like, well, that's right where your spleen is. Like, maybe it exploded. Let's get you to the hospital and see what's going on. And so they get me to the hospital and my spleen is fine. I ended up breaking my hand and sprained my ankle. And they're like, you know, go home. You'll feel better soon. And about a week after that, I started having pain in that same spot in my abdomen. And then I noticed that there was blood in my stool, which I was really freaked out about. And I was like, something is definitely wrong. So I went to my primary care doctor and they referred me to a gastroenterologist. And I got an appointment in a couple of weeks with them. And then they said that they would like to do a colonoscopy. And so about 2 weeks later, after that, we did the colonoscopy and it came back moderate, severe, left-sided ulcerative colitis. And they think that the stress of just the accident is kind of what brought it out. It could have maybe delayed a little bit longer, but you know, who's to say? They don't really know. So that was kind of the beginning of my diagnosis. I remember asking in that appointment, is there anything that I can eat or like anything I shouldn't eat? And I was told, diet doesn't matter. Here's your handout on what ulcerative colitis is. Take your medication that we're giving you, which they gave me prednisone for the flare, and then they gave me mesalamine pills to start with. And she said, take your medicine and just continue to live your life like normal. So I had never heard of ulcerative colitis or IBD or Crohn's. I had no idea what it was. I was told diet doesn't matter and given this little handout pamphlet about what it is and kind of just set out into the world. The prednisone did help the flare, and I continued to take the mesalamine for several years up until 2019. but I did take it in a few different forms. And I just kind of continued to live my life. I was 21 at the time of diagnosis, you know, and wanted to go party and have fun and, you know, did all those things in college and didn't really realize that that was not helping my IBD and kind of was able to manage. I would have maybe 3 or 4 flares a year and they would just give me the prednisone and then I would get better and then, you know, just kind of go back to how I was. So I just kind of was like, well, I guess I'll just be sick sometimes. That just seems to be how it is. And I just continued like this. I got my culinary arts degree and then I was going back to get my bachelor's in food service management and was working full-time in a restaurant and got promoted to being a sous chef. So then I was working full-time and doing school, which is a lot for anybody, and was eating like a lot of fast food and, you know, didn't really have time to cook for myself because I'm working like 60 hours a week and doing school. So I kind of managed like this for a while, but then the flares just kept getting like more severe. I was having to take more prednisone for longer periods of time. We continued to do the mesalamine pills, but also use the enemas and the suppositories. And so I did that for a few years, maybe it's 2017 to 2019. And then in 2018, I went to my doctor and he was like, you know, you're having quite a few flares every year. Remind me what you do again. What do you do for a living? And I was like, well, I'm a chef and this is how much I work. And he was like, I think you need to do something else. He was like, this is too stressful, too many hours. I think maybe you need to look at making some lifestyle changes. And so, I mean, I was devastated. Like, you know, I went to culinary school. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in fine dining and maybe have my own restaurant or something, and kind of had to put that on the back burner and ended up taking a job in my minor, which was beverage management. There's a local wine shop here. And so I started working there and then became an assistant manager and was there for 3 years. And, you know, that's more 40 hours, 45 instead of 60. And so that definitely did help. But in 2019, I had the worst flare I'd had and just was not getting better with the prednisone. And I went to see my GI specialist, who at the time was a couple hours away. Got there, I'm thinking, okay, like we'll get a new game plan, we'll get a new medication, something, and I'll go home. He looked at me and was like, we're admitting you to the hospital. So that was my first like IBD hospital experience and stay. And we ended up switching from mesalamine to Remicade. And so I was able to get my loading dose in the hospital. And within probably 2 to 3 weeks, I was starting to see improvement with the prednisone and the Remicade. And so I finished the loading doses and continued to take Remicade from 2019 to 2022. And in that time also, I kind of looked to see if there was something for diet that maybe I could do. Like my doctor told me it didn't really matter, but I knew that I had always been lactose intolerant, right? So I was like, let me get rid of dairy. And then I also just had done some reading on inflammatory foods. And so gluten was on there. And that was something I had a lot of. And so I was like, let me cut out gluten and dairy. And, you know, maybe that'll help some. And it did help in addition to the Remicade, but it still wasn't quite the improvement that I wanted to see. So I then tried the Plant Paradox diet for a while, which removes lectins, and that helped a little bit more than the gluten and dairy-free, but still not quite what I wanted it to be. And then in 2020, my husband's aunt, who's a nurse, kind of mentioned in passing, you know, I heard about this specific carbohydrate diet that is for people with Crohn's and colitis. You know, maybe you could look into it. And I was like, okay. And so I bought the book, Breaking the Vicious Cycle, and I read it. And as soon as I was done reading it, I was like, let's do it. Let's give it a go. I mean, it's for people with Crohn's and colitis. It's not going to hurt. I can try it. The worst thing that happens is I don't like it and I'll go back to Plant Paradox. It ended up helping me a ton with my symptoms. And it was just amazing to me that by choosing to have foods that are better for me and digest easier for me, I was helping my disease as much as I felt my medicine was. And so to me, that was really kind of a light bulb moment and very empowering, and, you know, was able to feel like there's something I can do to help. I did the intro diet, not as long as you're supposed to, though. And tried some of the recipes in the back of the book. And I was like, wow, these recipes are not that great. I was like, I don't know if I can do this if the food tastes like this. So I was like, well, this is something I want to do. And I have a culinary art background. I've worked in restaurants. You know, I know how to write a recipe. Let me try and see if I can make it even just a little bit better. So that's kind of what I did. I initially just started making recipes for myself. And then I had found a few things that actually were pretty good. And like, you kind of almost couldn't tell that they were SCD. And I was like, maybe other people would like these recipes too. And so then I decided to start a blog in 2020 in like October. And I named it Abigail Marie, the Chef with IBD. So that is how my blog came to be. And now it's got over 200 recipes on there. And I also have like some lifestyle things, like things that have helped me. Like I do a daily meditation and a gratitude journal and some like mindfulness movement, like Tai Chi or Qigong. And those things have really helped me. So I have that on there. Also just a lot of blog posts about upcoming medications, things kind of in the pipeline scientifically, because to me, I've had the greatest success with medication and diet in combination and like looking at lifestyle factors too. So I just want to be able to share all that information and let people be able to decide, you know, what's best for them. So I started my blog and then COVID, of course. So I was working the retail at the wine shop and my doctor was like, you can't really be seeing like 100 to 200 people a day. Like COVID's very new. We're not sure what the long-term things are. You're immune compromised, you know, with the Remicade. You know, I think maybe it would be best if you did something from home for a while. And so I was home like a lot of people for like a year. Tried to do some things online, but my degree really is for cooking. So it was very difficult to find something that I could do from home. But then I started my blog. And then in 2021, I started working at one of the local hospitals doing food service for hospital patients, which definitely was not the caliber of food that I wanted to do. But it was nice to be able to, you know, maybe give that person a little bit of joy. Like maybe that little dessert you're working on is the best part of their day, because hospitals are not a fun place to be. And so I did that for a while. And then in July of 2022, I started having a flare, and it was much more severe and escalated much faster than any other flare that I had had. And we started on the prednisone. Within a week, I was like maxed out at 80 milligrams. They didn't want to prescribe anymore. I was in between GI doctors at the time because my GI had just retired. So my only contact was the nurse practitioner, and she just wasn't comfortable giving me anything else. So I ended up going to the hospital. It ended up being 37 day stay and three separate admissions. Between the first and second was 12 hours I was home, and between the second and third was 24 hours. And it was really rough. I'm so thankful to have my husband and my dad and brother here to help me and help take care of me. And the hospital could not accommodate any food for me for SCD. They just said, we're not going to touch it. So my husband and dad and brother like made my food and brought it to me every day. But I was just losing a massive amount of blood and they were not sure why. We did a Flexig and they said there's severe ulcerations. We can see that. I think all the blood is just coming from the ulcerations. It was kind of like no one knew what to do with me. I was just on the maximum steroids. At one point, they were like, I really think you're facing steroid failure. It doesn't seem that these steroids are doing anything for you, and you're just continuously getting worse. I had lost like 35, 40 pounds in maybe a month and was really, really weak. And when I came home from the hospital, I couldn't walk up the stairs. Like my husband had to carry me. I ended up taking two ambulance rides. Also, the last ambulance ride, my dad and my husband had called 911 because I had just passed out in the bathroom on the floor and I was non-responsive. And so they called 911 and they got there. And I remember them taking my blood pressure and then them saying about something like, it's not right, it's not working. And so I'm like, okay, well, the blood pressure cuff doesn't work. Turns out my blood pressure was so low, it could not get a reading. So my heart rate at 2 over 200 and a bottoming out blood pressure. They rushed me to the hospital and immediately gave me a blood transfusion. I ended up having 6 blood transfusions. Like, it was so scary. I didn't know if I was going to be coming home with all of my organs, if I was going to be coming home at all. It was definitely very scary. And I was very close to death, which I kind of didn't realize in the moment. But looking back and looking at the labs and listening to my new GI doctor, it was really scary. I thankfully was able to get a new GI while I was in the hospital. And he suggested, why don't we try Renvoke? He was like, it really looks like steroid failure. I'll give you 7 days. If we can get your insurance to approve the Renvoke, you have 7 days. And if you start to get better, then great. If not, we're going to do a complete colectomy. And so, I mean, I was just scared to death. The insurance ended up approving the Renvoke. I was like, let's give it a try. I know it's new, but, you know, I'm kind of, my back is up against the wall here. So we ended up doing the Renvoke. I did a double loading dose. So for 16 weeks, I did the loading dose, and then it ended up helping. I was able to come home. It took me 4 months to recover, like to be able to just walk around by myself and like take care of myself. And it was definitely a long recovery. Also, when I came home, all of my hair fell out. So it was like really just stringy. And I went to my hairdresser and I was like, can you do anything? And she was like, we can buzz it and start over. She was like, that is all that we can do. And I was like, okay. And so February of last year, 2023, I buzzed my hair and have been regrowing it. It's definitely coming back now though. But yeah, so that was kind of a big, you know, thing for me. And especially, you know, just being a woman, that is like, just hits your confidence. You know, it's one thing if you're like, want to rock the shaved head, but having to do it, you know, just because you don't have a choice is a little different. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize that like massive IBD flares or lack of nutrition and things like that can cause hair loss. So IBD can cause that. And that is what happened with me. So know if that happens, you're not alone. And I did wear a wig for a little bit and a lot of hats at first. but yeah, it's growing back out now. And, you know it's just hair and it'll come back. But yeah, so that was kind of something else in my journey that I wanted to share. And then I have been taking the Renvoke since 2022 and have been doing really well. In November, early November, I went and got my annual colonoscopy and everything's looking like histologic remission, which is great. And I'm still doing the SCD. Kind of doing all those things together has really helped kind of give me my life back. And I just want to be able to share that. And I actually started working with nutritional therapy for IBD. They reached out to me last year. I think I've been there for about 8 months now. And it's just an incredible resource. Kim had reached out to me to see if I wanted to volunteer to help them with some of their things. And I just could not believe how in-depth the website is and with all of the scientific information and the medical advisory board. I was blown away. Like, what an amazing resource. And they have information on SCD. They also have all the different other therapeutic diets for IBD. So it's really a wonderful place to send patients and clinicians if they're interested in using nutritional therapy to help their IBD. You know, it's not one size fits all. You really have to figure out what is best for you. But just having the information and having the knowledge to choose, I think that is really empowering and a win for people with IBD.
Wow, what a story. This is where I wish that Robin and I used the video because we were both like, wow, oh my gosh.
I know, I could see your faces.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I always like to throw in disclaimers or do repeats. Anyone who's listening, if you do not see an IBD specialist, which I know we don't all have access to IBD specialists, sometimes we have to see community GIs, sometimes we have to see family doctors. First of all, here's my color commentary. I'm like so floored right now. I can't even believe that in the year of our Lord, 2017, Abigail was getting steroids as much as she was. I just am floored that was the rescue medicine that they went to so often for you. I am like physically nauseous about that for you.
Oh, yeah. It was a lot. Like looking back now and knowing, I'm like, why? Like, why?
Yeah, it wasn't your choice. So here's my PSA for anyone out there in 2024. if you are seeing a doctor outside of the IBD specialty world, sometimes they call themselves IBDologists, centers of excellence, whatever they want to call themselves. If you are seeing somebody outside of that realm and they want to give you steroids, I say please, pretty please, with a cherry on top, please get a second opinion. There is evidence, there is research, there's lots of data that shows that steroids are just not the best way to go for people with IBD. There's so many other treatment options out there for people with IBD, and steroids are just not the best first option for us.
It's not a long-term option for sure. I mean, like, on it, we've had, at least two people on that have gone into, like, have become dependent on steroids, and thus it caused some other issues. I mean, listen, I don't think there's anything better to stop inflammation really, 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 really fast, but it's if your doctor wants to keep you on it long-term, for sure, that's not a good plan.
Yes.
Yeah. And it wasn't that I took it long term. It was just that I took it with the flares, but I was having so many each year that it was like, it was becoming problematic. Yeah. And after my hospitalization, when they were giving me 80 milligrams IV for 37 days, you know, I actually developed cataracts because of the high steroid usage.
I am so sorry that that happened to you, Abigail. I'm so, so sorry that that happened to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know any better. And
of course not.
I've had four different GIs now. And the one I have now, I like the best. He's amazing. But it's
How would you know?
Yeah. Like,
of course
21,
not.
I have no idea. They're just saying, hey, take this medicine, live your life. It'll be fine.
There's no way for you to know.
100%. You know, when you're 21 years old and somebody says, no, take this medicine, you'll be fine, go live your life. Why wouldn't you believe them? That's what you want to hear.
Right.
And you don't know what this is.
I'm so, so sorry that this happened to you.
Also, the fact that they're like, maybe you shouldn't be a chef.
Oh my God. Thank you for bringing that up. Go jump off of a bridge. Yes. Maybe you should give her a better treatment option. Yeah. All of the treatment options that were available in 2014 and 2015 and 2016 and 2017.
Yeah.
Sir, doctor, sir, you should give her a better treatment option to manage her disease.
Yeah. And it was kind of just like, well, I've done what I can do, address your lifestyle type, you know?
That's not okay.
And I didn't know what an autoimmune disease was. Like, I didn't realize that it was a chronic illness. No. Like, I was given the pamphlet. That was it.
I'm so disgusted with doctors right now on your behalf. So disgusted. No,
I was just about to say, I'm so sorry that the medical community failed you so badly.
They failed you so bad.
That's so many missed opportunities to have made a difference much faster. And for you, hopefully, to have not, I mean, there's no guarantee, but for you to have never gotten to the point where you're passing out and almost dying from your disease. Like, that's...
Yeah.
I really need to get a thesaurus because all I want to say is it's just so fucked up. Like, it's just so fucked up. So...
Anyway.
Okay. Okay, Abigail, I love that you were able to use your background, your profession. I think it's so interesting you were able to use, take your profession and be able to turn it into something that I think could be so valuable to so many people. Because the SCD is specific carbohydrate diet, is a challenging diet from what I've heard. I've not been on it. But when we were talking to Kim Brawley about this, who is a dietitian, very versed in this, one of the things I brought up is, you know, it's gotten better, but a lot of the food you have to make everything. Like, there is no store-bought version of crackers or yogurt or some of this stuff. And so I love that you, having somebody with your background, can really make this such a much more accessible experience. Talk me through a little bit about the first time you decided to do a recipe. Was that intimidating, or did you because of your background, you're like, I got this?
So the recipe itself, I was not intimidated by that. Like, in every class, part of our final would be to make a recipe, type it up, and then actually make it and give it to the professor with the recipe. And so the actual making the recipe, totally fine. Some of the STD ingredients I had never worked with, almond flour, coconut flour. It was just a whole new world to me. That part was kind of intimidating, even as a chef, you know, to just figure out how these ingredients interact with each other. So that was kind of more the trial and error part. But as far as writing the recipes, that kind of just came naturally.
So for anybody who's considering this, and I'm sure this is on your blog, your website as well, which we will link in the show notes, everybody. But for somebody who's starting this out, maybe for themselves or for their child, what are some like culinary tips you give them? Things that you've learned?
First, I think it's helpful to just make one meal for everyone instead of trying to make three or four separate meals for the whole family. So I really have tried to make my recipes family friendly and, you know, things that most people like. So that is one thing. Another thing is like when you go to the grocery store and you buy all your vegetables and stuff for the week, when you bring them home, like just go ahead and wash them and prep them up so they're ready waiting for you, because that will save you so much time. And then, you know, sometimes like if you're tired in the kitchen, take a seat, like sit down while you're chopping up your vegetables. You know, you don't have to be standing. So just kind of doing small things like prepping the vegetables or sitting down, you know, you're saving yourself time, you're saving yourself energy. And those are some of the most valuable things you have. Like, just make it work for you.
So you said that nutritional therapy for IBD sought you out. So obviously they had seen your blog and your recipe. So what was that like? What was their approach to you?
Yeah, Kim had seen my page on Instagram and looked at my website. And I'm always looking to be able to help in the IBD community and to be an advocate and a voice. And we just really aligned on, you know, our values and why we're here. And I was more than happy to hop on board. And I started helping with some social media, and I also provided some recipes that you can find on their recipe database. And then kind of as it morphed, they needed a event coordinator. And so I filled the role of being their event coordinator, which has been a lot of fun. And we were out at Crohn's and Colitis Congress, which was cool. We saw you guys there. And yeah, so I do that. And then I also help with their newsletter as well.
Can we talk a little bit about more about working in the hospital? I'm curious, because you were using SED at that time, right?
Yep.
You said the hospital that you went to wasn't able to really accommodate that. In your experience of working within a hospital, do you see them getting better about accommodating different dietary needs?
Unfortunately, not really. You know, for SED, it's like you can't use canola oil and things like that. It has to be olive oil. The hospital I was staying at told me we don't have any olive oil, so we can't make you eggs or chicken breast or whatever. So that was frustrating, because at the time, yeah, I also was working in a hospital. I know that you have a steamer and you can just steam it. You know, So I think, unfortunately, it kind of just becomes like, that's too risky, or that's not my job type thing, because the people staying in the hospital don't really want to be there. And I've found that a lot of people working there don't want to be there either, at least in food service. And so, yeah, it's just kind of one of those things. And I was fortunate enough to have, you know, my dad and my husband and my brother bringing me food and taking care of me, although I really could not eat. I was not really able to eat that much during that stay, but, you know, at least I had the option of something. But yeah, unfortunately, it's just kind of like, it falls through the cracks. It's an area that I really wish could be improved. All hospital food service are all contracted out with, you know, particular food service groups. Okay. And so it's really difficult to make any change because there's a lot of red tape.
That's really unfortunate, because the people who need the highest quality food are
in the hospital. Yes.
Not getting it. They're not getting it. We haven't gotten on a soapbox about hospital food on our podcast.
It's even different, like not in America. It's really like American healthcare food, because other countries have actual real food that's not so processed. But It's like, the problem is when people are sick, they want comfort food, and American comfort food is not good for you.
Right.
And so even if they have the healthy options, they're not going to sell, because that's not what people want. And if you look at it, the hospital food is really not very different from what the average American is eating anyway. So to them, it's really not that much of a change, which is super unfortunate. And with everything being contracted out, you know, you just have the major chain brands for food supply all contracted within. So it's like, you can't do anything, because it's all these massive corporations that are running all the food for the hospitals. And, you know, it's something that I wish would be different. And, you know, I wish wasn't so difficult to change.
So Robin and I, when we saw you at Crohn's and Colitis Congress, one of the questions I asked Robin is that because her, at some point, her diet was extremely limited because of kind of how symptomatic she was, and also being a chef and having foods that sort of trigger her not doing very well. I asked her, like, how did you function as a chef when you're not necessarily able to eat some of the food or try the things that you're making? So I want to get your take on this, because Robin's is that she has a very developed sense of smell. So she's able to kind of like, she can use that instead of her taste palette. She can use her scent palette instead. I want to get your take on this.
Yeah. I mean, definitely being able to smell like what you're making is helpful. Like you can tell how sweet it is or how spicy it is, or if it is like under seasoned or over seasoned by smelling. When I was working as a sous chef, my husband actually worked there as a sous chef also. So a lot of times I just had him taste my stuff. Working in the hospital, I would just have like the executive chef taste it or one of my counterparts or colleagues. And, you know, like I'd get two or three different opinions and then also be able to smell it. So then I could make my own opinion about it. But cooking is kind of just following your heart anyway. So it's not really as much of a science as baking is. So you can kind of just, you can have fun. I guess just through experience and having other people taste stuff.
I want to stay with nutrition therapy for IBD a little bit longer. What kind of statistics are you seeing for like the utilization of their like recipe database and some of that stuff? Are they gaining a lot of traction? Because it's been around for a couple of years now. So I definitely think that this would be getting a lot of attention because this is such a hot topic in our community.
For the newsletter, we're just starting to do one every month instead of one quarterly because we've gotten more subscribers and more feedback and people wanting it more regularly. So we definitely have seen that. We just launched our new website not too long ago. So all the recipes are on there and it's a lot more user-friendly and easier to navigate. And you can also make a little profile now and you can save your favorite recipes or like comment on them or rate them, give them little stars. And so I think that has been super helpful. And we've gotten a lot of really good feedback with people being able to use that. And just the site itself being a little bit easier to navigate because it's such a massive resource and amount of information, which is amazing, but you have to be able to sift through it, right? So I think we've done a really good job of kind of reorganizing and making it a lot easier.
And Robin was extolling the virtues of the sort of chart that outlines all the different therapeutic diets and kind of compares and contrasts and saying how great that is and how much easier it is to use than perhaps other information that's out there. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, at Crohn's and Colitis Congress, we got a lot of doctors that are now saying, okay, we do think diet matters, but we don't have the time or the resources to seek out all this information to give it back to our patients. Mm-hmm. And that is where a lot of GIs were like very thankful for us as a resource because they can just send the patient to the website. It has all of the different types of diet that have evidence and scientific research backing them. And the patient can kind of figure out, hey, what do I think is maybe best for me? What do I want to try under the guidance of my doctor? And so that was really neat to see, you know, kind of that it, the narrative is starting to change a little bit because I so wish that someone had told me that diet mattered in the very beginning.
Yeah, you're not the only person. I mean, that friend of the show, Stacey Collins, like if you go to her website, that's like the very first thing she has on there is like, the reason I started doing this is because somebody told me like diet didn't matter. And I, exactly what you said, like, I just wanted to know what can I eat? And
yeah. Stacey and I are actually friends.
Yay, friend of the show and friend of you.
Yeah.
One of the things you definitely wanted to talk about, and I'm curious how this sort of is integrated into the nutrition therapy for IBD sort of experience, is the sense of community. Like, how do you build a community and the importance of that? So tell us why did you want to talk about this, number one, but also how do you see this integrating into your journey?
So kind of initially when I got my diagnosis, I'm learning about what this is. I did not know anyone that had IBD. I had never even heard of it. And so that was very isolating for me. And, you know, you're having all these symptoms that are not cute. Like, you know, who do you talk to about this? Who understands? And it really never occurred to me to seek out a IBD community because I don't know. I didn't even think it existed until I started my blog and kind of putting that out there, you know, on Instagram and online and just getting all the feedback and seeing all these people that understand exactly what I'm going through and what I've been through. Like, that was just so amazing and so empowering. It's just great to know that you're not alone. And so that kind of was, I don't know, like that's a big part of my story and of my journey now. And so I just want everyone to be able to find their community because it really helped me and, you know, like mental health wise and everything too, you know, just knowing that you're not alone and there are people rooting for you and you'll get through it. That was really comforting and empowering me.
You know, as somebody who doesn't have inflammatory bowel disease, I can't imagine how powerful it is to have the sense of community or the people around you that do completely get it. Because, you know, your husband and your brother and your dad sound like they're amazing supports to you, but they don't have the disease. They don't understand it. I don't understand it. Except from what I hear from people. And so, you know, while we can be empathetic, it's not the same at all. So I think that's really important.
Yeah. And, you know, nutritional therapy for IBD also is a great resource and great sense of community with everyone that I work with and the other volunteers and all the feedback that we've gotten and everything. So I think it's just, it's important and I'm glad to be able to be a part of it.
So I'm curious when you started your blog, because one of the things we've joked about with people and frankly, every episode that we publish the morning that I wake up and it's in my app, it's a little intimidating every single time. And we've been doing this for 117 or 1,000 episodes, it feels like. So I am curious, having now had your blog for a little while, have you had some times where you've published something that you were like a little nervous about?
Not really. I did write this one blog post about a study that just posed the question, is ultra-processed food something that can impact IBD diagnosis? And I got a lot of very negative pushback on that one.
Really?
Because people were like, this is dangerous. You're playing the blame game. You're saying this is their fault. And I'm like, whoa, like, let's back up. I did not say any of that. The study actually was inconclusive. Like I was just posing the question, right? So I did get like a lot of commentary on that was not super positive. but that's the only time, really.
Do you think some of it is a misunderstanding of like what that is? Like, because, you know, when you say ultra processed food, I like certainly have an idea of it, but I don't know that I know what it is. Like, I just think like boxed food is probably ultra processed. But is there like,
I mean, it's really anything that like, this is not the definition, but this would be my definition. Okay. Like anything that you look at that is food that does not actually look like food, like a donut. Like you do not see that anywhere in nature. You know what I mean? Like
there's no donut trees.
Yeah. Like you really had to process every single ingredient in there to make it into what that is, you know? And so it's just, it can be tricky. Like there are so many additives, so many different emulsifiers and like, you know, a lot of things that are approved for food that maybe we should not be eating and that we don't really have the information, the long-term information to understand how it's really impacting us, like food coloring. So it can be kind of tricky, but it's sort of just, to me, it's like, if that doesn't really look like anything more natural, then it's pretty processed. Definitely all fast food.
Yeah, but then you're getting into access to food and...
Right, and not everyone has equal access. And yeah, like that is also a huge issue. And you eat what is affordable. And unfortunately, that's not always what is good for you.
Yeah. Or what's available. And that's not always, you know, great either. Because I mean, I think about some of these food deserts with people that are shopping in like a convenience store, essentially.
Right.
Like not a lot of options for you. So that is difficult. And listen, at one point I read that Skittles were banned in Europe because of one of the dyes. And I didn't care. I ate all of them. I was like, good, more Skittles for me, Europe. That's how I felt about that. So listen, I'm all about the processing, apparently.
No, I mean, and it definitely has its place. And, you know, like it's not, we shouldn't be labeling foods as good and bad. It's, you know, and that's a whole other topic. But,
you know, I want to agree with you, but I don't, because I do think that like at some point we are going to learn that there's like you said, there could be something that we're putting into food. Maybe it's not the food itself, but that we're putting into food that is potentially causing harm. I mean, at some point we used to take arsenic because it made our skin look great, you know, like.
Right. And it's
still
like
not good for you.
Yeah. We just don't have the data right now. We just don't have it. So I can't objectively call it bad if I don't know that it's bad.
Can I rewind back to your story a little bit? And when you were hospitalized and you're like needing blood transfusions and all of that, explain to me a little bit about like, did they better explain your disease at that point? Like, did you have an understanding of like how these were connected? Like, do you remember because you were really, really ill at that point and you probably don't remember any of it? Talk a little bit more about kind of just because like that's, it's such a dramatic thing.
Yeah, like I definitely am missing like big parts. I also got COVID for the first time while I was hospitalized. And that week was really a blur. Like I did not really remember much of that except that I had to keep getting blood transfusions and that they had to give me oxygen because I was having a hard time breathing and just being like pretty much alone for that week because no one could come see me. My husband also got COVID. Like that was probably one of the roughest parts. Yeah, like I definitely am missing big parts and portions.
Like, did they better explain kind of how things were connected at any point? Because like, again, blood transfusions are not necessarily something that people probably go, oh yeah, you might need a blood transfusion with a bowel disease.
Yeah, it really was because I was losing such a massive amount of blood and so quickly and every day. I had definitely never had a flare that bad. When they initially did the Flexig, they were like, your ulcerations are looking crazy, but I don't really see anything else. Like, we're just going to keep you on the steroids. Eventually, on the third admission, they did a full colonoscopy. And right where my small intestine and my large intestine meet, there was like a huge like gash in it, basically. That's where all the extra blood was coming from and why I was losing so much blood. I can't think of the word that they called it, but they ended up clipping. They ended up putting 3 clips on that area to try and fuse it back together, basically, so that it could heal. And funny enough, the clips are supposed to be there for 3 to 6 months, and then they're supposed to fall out by themselves. For my last colonoscopy I got in November, one of the clips is still there. And they're like, oh, surprise, this is still here. And I was like, what are we supposed to do about that? They were like, it's okay, it'll fall out eventually. But yeah, so I had just like a huge gash in the colon itself. And so that is where all the extra blood was coming from and why it was so painful. But they were able to clip it and it did heal up. There's some scar tissue kind of all throughout my entire colon because of this last flare. But otherwise, they said it's looking pretty good. So they didn't really explain my disease to me any better. They did have me have a consult with surgery to explain what a complete colectomy was to me, but I already knew. But yeah, it was just kind of getting thrown around from GI to GI and the hospital to hospitalist doctors, and it was just sort of like nobody really knew what to do with me, and it was a lot of hurry up and wait for nothing. And eventually my GI that I have now, he wasn't even taking new patients at the time, but he heard about my case from one of the other gastroenterologists at his practice that would do his rounds at the hospital. And he called me on a Saturday night on his personal time at 9 o'clock just to introduce himself and say that he was happy to take my case on. And, you know, we're going to find some options. And, you know, no matter if it ends up being a colectomy or not, you know, he would be my new GI, which I was really thankful to have him. And he also had some experience prescribing Rinvoq anyway. And so he knew much more about it than any of the GIs at the hospital. So he's really the reason that we were able to go with Rinvoq.
Yeah, he sounds like he was actually keeping up with the research and, you know, being much more understanding of what it was. And my guess is probably, and you know, and again, I'm don't want to excuse bad behavior because some of this was probably just bad behavior, but I'm assuming it because you did cycle through a couple of doctors that everybody probably assumed you'd gotten the education and that's why, but also like you got to kind of ask at least.
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah, it was like each GI specialist would do a week, would do 7 days, and then it would be a new specialist. So I got like, you know, over 37 days, I got a lot of different doctors.
It's kind of nice to be able to at least try them out, right? You get a chance to say, well, I like this one better than that one, or, you know, so kind of, yeah. I mean,
I guess I, unfortunately, I just did not really receive good care from almost anyone during that whole time. And they were so understaffed. And so there were just so many people in the hospital. Like there were people in the hallway, like they were out of beds, they were understaffed, they were tired, still end of pandemic. Like it just translated to me not getting the best care, but it wasn't perfect, but they did save my life, you know?
I'm familiar with that kind of care.
And I'm like terrified of needles, and they were drawing so much blood every single day. And it was like, that was really stressful for me. I had a bad experience with a blood draw when I was really little. And ever since then, I get very nauseous and pass out a lot of the time. So
there's a lot of needles involved in inflammatory bowel disease, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then doing the Remicade for several years, every 6 weeks. So that was a lot of needles too, but I'm getting better. We're working through it.
I think you kind of have to. I mean, at some point you have to just suck it up and do it, because what are your choices? So I am curious, Abigail, just if now that you're feeling better, you're in a better place, you've, you know, created all these new recipes from the specific carbohydrate diet. Are you going back to thinking about opening a restaurant of your own someday?
That is a good question. I don't know. I kind of feel like my dreams have changed a little bit. Like, I really would love to be able to do a cookbook. If I'm really dreaming, like, I would love to start like an SCD brand, so that it kind of levels the playing field and makes it more accessible, like an SCD cake mix box, ketchup, barbecue sauce, crackers, all these things that you normally buy at the store, just to have it be more accessible and easier, because I love cooking and I don't mind making all my own stuff, but I know that not everybody enjoys cooking or not everybody has time for that. And so, you know, maybe being able to help out in that capacity would be cool. So, yeah.
I'd love that.
Yeah.
Robin, get in on that.
You could get in on the ground floor right now.
Yes, get on the ground floor. That was going to be my next question. I was going to ask, so what's next for you, Abigail? That was going to be my question. But over the course of this conversation, maybe that's why I've been thinking about, I need to go to your website and start cooking some of your recipes.
Yeah, please do.
I am going to.
Let me know what you think. I welcome feedback of any kind.
Do you have a favorite recipe? Like, is there one that you created that you're like, hell yeah, that's amazing?
I am like a really big dessert person. So I definitely have a lot of dessert recipes that I've made that I really like. I'm actually working this week on a blondie recipe and it's pretty great. I'm really happy with it. I also have like a coffee ice cream, dairy-free ice cream, because coffee ice cream was my favorite, like always growing up. And that one is like, it's spot on. So I really like that one too. Yeah, there's a lot of dessert recipes. Like, I have a cake, like a cupcake, strawberry cupcake recipe with like vanilla icing. I like that a lot. I'm going to make that into a big cake actually on Sunday for my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thanks.
I will be trying the recipes. I will be sending you not feedback, but just like, that was delicious.
Or even if you're like, hey, I think it'd be better like this, or maybe change this, like I'm open to whatever.
Oh no, it's going to be like the reviews, the notes on like recipe.com, like where they don't even make it like the recipe, like, oh, I added this and changed that. It was perfect every time.
Yeah.
And it's like, they basically made a completely different item that you're gonna be like, but I did like this, Abigail, I did it like this. And you're going to say, that's not even my recipe at all. So glad you liked it. That's not my recipe. So first of all, I just want to say that when we spoke the other day and you said, I don't have a complicated story. I feel like you undersold. You buried the lead. I mean, maybe just a little bit, Abigail, just a little bit. But now that we know your story, it's been lovely getting to know you better. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing so openly with us everything that you went through. I think it's going to be very helpful. We are definitely going to share your recipes with everyone. It's the first time we've really shared recipes on the show, except for maybe Stacy's smoothie recipes. So I'm excited to be able to share recipes with everyone. But it's time for me to ask you our last question. And that is, what is the one thing you want the IBD community to know?
I just want them to know that they're not alone. There are so many people that completely understand exactly what you're going through or what you've been through, you know, so don't be afraid to reach out, because there are a lot of people here to support you and cheer you on.
Absolutely. That is 100% true. And that's what makes this community so beautiful. It really is so lovely to see how people come together and support each other in this community. So 100% agree. Abigail, it has been such a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing it. We really, really appreciate it. And I know people are really going to enjoy getting to know your recipes and your blog and seeing your work at Nutrition Therapy for IBD. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everybody else, for joining us. And cheers.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. Hi, this is Abigail. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, subscribe, and share it with your friends.